On the show today, we have the endlessly knowledgeable Uncle Wayne Fossey. Uncle Wayne is a fierce advocate for Indigenous land rights, environmental health, and sustainable living. He shares some uplifting and informative and at times confronting stories. Don't miss this opportunity to absorb these elder wisdoms. I hope you enjoy the show.
Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.
Hello and welcome to the podcast today. We've got Uncle Wayne Fossey joining us today. Welcome, Uncle. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Danielle. Thanks. It's great to be here. What a beautiful spot.
So with welcoming Uncle, I'd love you to tell us who's your mob, where you're from, what a good looking bloke like you is doing in my house.
Part of the world.
Correct.
My background from mum's side comes through Yugambeh, through Gugujin, Yugambeh language group, and through Gugujin. And from my dad's side, my grandfather came off Raglan Station, which is near to Rockhampton, and not quite sure of the mob because they were moved around in different groups. And my grandfather spent a lot of time after he was 13 moving into the western parts of Queensland. So he developed a fair bit of time on the Downs and certainly out into the west past Roma.
It sounds like you've been travelling around it a lot, and I love that whenever I talk to Uncle, he goes, "Oh yeah, I've done that," or "I've done this." Take me back to you being a young man and travelling around and ending out. So where did you grow up? You grew up in Roma?
No, my start to life was actually in Nambour on Kabi Kabi country, and I had the great privilege of being brought up with Aboriginal neighbours and also our South Sea Island friends and families like Egmises, Baikwars, Foresters. And so we had the opportunity with a fairly free and easy lifestyle as kids. My early life was spent, mum and my dad came back from World War II as a soldier and end up being taken on board by a family with some housing after he got married. So my parents had a tin shed down on the banks of Petrie Creek with a dirt floor and a shared house cow between three families for soldiers back from World War II, due to the generosity of a man who'd wanted to take care of people at the end of the war.
So where did you go to school?
Yeah, school for me was Nambour. Nambour, I had the opportunity in the early days, actually the first up, to actually go to a preschool. And it had just been built. My dad sort of helped to build it and refit it, which was a great opportunity. And then to be able to go to the primary school in Nambour and the secondary school in Nambour. And I'd made a decision that I'd really wanted to stay at secondary school, unlike other members of my family and relatives and so forth. So in that time, many of our mates and our kids and my relatives left at age 12 or 11. I managed to stay on. Dad was always very positive in saying, if you want to stay on, I'll support you, I'll help you, let's have a look at this. So I stayed on to do grade 8, I stayed on to do junior in those days and also to do senior. And then you come to that magic decision about, oh, wow, what do we do after that? Where do we want to go? And I'd won a scholarship or two for the opportunity to go to the uni. So it was a good opportunity.
Did you know anybody who'd been to university yourself?
No, I was the first out of our family, in any shape or form, to do junior, let alone to do senior, let alone to go to uni. So it was a big change, a huge change to be able to do that. So my first wanderings into Brisbane, except for a funeral, or except to go to visit somebody who was sick, was to go to university. Dad came down in a truck with a half-filled tea chest with my life's possessions in it and dropped me off at a person's house. I think my scholarship was about $18.40 a week, and my board and lodging was $17. So no bike, no car, no money, and good luck. And, my parents didn't have a house phone, so, you were really on your own, and then each holidays to be able to make sure you worked to be able to sustain your university studies and to do other things as well. So, I managed to survive doing that through uni. decided that I wanted to become a teacher. So that meant leaving uni at that time in a complicated sort of set of circumstances, and before you're 20 to be able to start teaching. And then, of course, you get the opportunity to become a conscripted soldier to join up either in the conscripted army at that time when the Vietnam was on, or you take the opportunity to be able to change in a different way to become a reserve soldier or not to do it at all. So I went through the conscript process for a short period of time, opted out into the local group, and then opted out back into teaching once all the politics had changed to be able to do so. So yeah, it was a good chance, but I've managed to be able to do things in environmental science and lots of things in education and things in philosophy and things in different areas that sort of, hopefully will make you a more rounded individual on this planet and better for the planet in the longer term and the shorter term.
We work a lot with Uncle Wayne in our cultural immersions and teaching, and so we've been having a few yarns about different ways that we can incorporate a lot of his knowledge, and he has a lot of plant medicine knowledge. We went up to Binnaburra Lodge there to have a look just before the big fires went through. And you did a lot of work up there as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we've had, I think, a group of people over time who've been interested in how forests work and how forests change. And I think what we think is that when we see old forests, that they were like that for the last, 2,000 years or whatever. And in many cases, the rainforest is the most complicated and the greatest variety and diversity of all sorts of things. It makes it really exciting. And it makes it exciting. It's not as big a diversity of animals, but it's certainly a bigger diversity of plants. And it's great to see that people in previous eras and previous epochs of our world were able to live across the rainforest, and especially on the edges of rainforests. So if you have a look at places like Binnaburra or O'Reilly's and along that plateau into northern New South Wales, that linked up the great forests. And the great forest was the largest great forest to exist in Australia. And it existed well and truly up until the period just before World War One. So a huge diversity of plants, a huge diversity of opportunities. So out of that came really fascinating things like macadamias, which now became commercial macadamias. Out of that came sort of versions of avocados and various fruits and plants and activities that will create, betterment for the future. So maintaining rainforest to me is really important because I think there are lots of secrets in rainforests that would benefit humans as well as they have benefited, generations upon generations of our mobs.
I think where we first met, I met you up at Bunya Mountains with the elders group up there. What really struck me that was quite sad about these beautiful, magnificent big bunya trees was the fact that they were dying. And not only like on an ecological sense, but I think on a spiritual sense as well, like the death of these big giants is heartbreaking to a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Can you tell us what's happening up there in the mountains with the bunya trees?
I think the key thing about the bunyas of very, very ancient trees, and a lot of estimates that were carried out by people would suggest that they're, relatively new, 200 or 300 years of age. We've dated the last series that have come to the ground for various reasons, and they're running into 400, 600, and 800 years. So we've been out by many hundreds of percent when we try to age them. In the past, the bunyas were the places to go for the gigantic bunya festivals, held every 3 years, but also held yearly, and the huge crops came three yearly. So bunyas were a very significant food source, ceremonial opportunity, and also the opportunity to be able to take people on board and to carry out cultural practices, marriage practice, and to be able to take at any one time. The suggestion has been that up to 12,000 people accumulated around the edges of the bunyas, coming from the north, the south, the east, and the west. And there are records and stories that exist from people coming from Eora, from Sydney, north of Sydney area, and coming from St. Lawrence and Rockhampton from that side, people coming definitely from Cunnamulla, and people coming from New South Wales, and coming on invite into the territory that belonged to a series of clans on the bunyas. So the bunyas hold this magic of culture, but also this magic of a particular tree. And we're never quite sure the age of many of our trees, and unfortunately they've been affected by a rather strange it's not really an organism. It's not a fungus. It's not a virus. It's not a bacterium. It's a it's called Phytophthora, and there are seven sorts of Phytophthora, of which three of them have now appeared on the bunya. We'd suggest they've been carried through stock feed and taken through wild pigs, and the pigs drop them through their saliva at the base of the trees, and eventually kill off the roots and kill off the trees, especially when they're stressed by drought and that dryness that's been around for some time.
To me, the bunya trees hold such a potent energy. Was there something special there that you know of in stories?
I think the key thing is that people were invited to the bunyas, and there's got to be a major reason why thousands of people would walk for months at a time, give birth, die, go through ceremony, and then create an opportunity to come together. And they're pretty obvious sort of opportunities there to get married or to sort out fights, or it was really the parliament of the time, probably with all the fights and feeds that parliaments have anyway. But there's something else that's way beyond any of those, and that's that feeling that when you get amongst those particular trees and in that environment, what you feel is that closeness to nature. Nature's a part of you. You're a part of the real world, and it has this of its own healing capacity to be able to do that. The thing that you felt that we all feel, and it's been felt by people whether they come from a local area or from far away. And I still find it hard to imagine that when we go onto our Gumindjeri Rock Arrangement site, to think of that as a male borer ground. Where thousands upon thousands of young men have been initiated under a specific ceremony on their way to the bunyas. And this was repeated across literally dozens and hundreds of sites. And an incredible feeling that when you arrive at the base of the bunyas and you're invited onto that site, and families have their own trees, and their trees were, you're actually invited all the time. So it's inviting your special relatives and your newly found relatives to be relatives by through marriage or kinship. And it's that feeling that something else gives you nature. Nature is sharing that life with you. It's that opportunity to be part of a world that we can't find in any other particular way.
It's a different feeling to, say, standing amongst the rainforest at, say, Binnaburra, yeah, or something like that. It feels totally different. Like, there's still amazing, massive big trees, and you're like standing in this beautiful rainforest, but it just feels very different to me.
You're right. And it's hard to find a word in English that actually sort of describes that feeling, because often it's part of what I would refer to as the sigh. You know, you get to the top of the ridge in the forest, and then you sort of sigh, like, I've arrived, I'm here. And then what you've got is that spirit of relaxation, but at the same time, as you said, it's perfect that you've got that idea of excitement and invigoration, that you feel energetic, you feel that there's something special. And when you go to other spots besides the Bunya Mountain, like the Kilkeven Bunya Forest, the same sort of feeling is there. It's not as pronounced because the trees aren't as big. So it's something to do with the complexity of how that world sort of envelops you and makes you see. Because you can look to the sky. So there are the night stories of the bunyas. There's the day stories of the bunyas. There's the animals that inhabit. 60% of our activity happens during the daylight hours, but there's a good 40% happening at night. So that opportunity is that animals and plants will actually be participating within the night sky, and it does make you feel sort of closer to that night creation. With that feeling in mind, I think it's significant that Aboriginal people firmly believe that their ancestors over a long, long period of time were linked by stories along the song lines and the storyline. So the bunyas is a part of that key storyline, and also you've got a linkage of the fact that the astronomy, the night sky, is a part of that. So the belief is that we came from the night sky, and that the semi sort of human animal combination beings came to Earth, and the stories go beyond that. So for the bunyas, there's a link between the bunyas outside, the bunya connection outside Dolby with Lake Broadwater, as we call it, and Lake Broadwater with the concept of a gigantic serpent creating landscape, creating the holes, the ridges, the hills, the landscape opportunities for the future, and disappearing into the earth and coming out near Maidenwell, and a part of how that story began to come alive. and then heading back to the north again. So there's linkage across not one group of Aboriginal people, but literally without the state boundaries, which are irrelevant, to be able to link all of the elements of night sky, day, all plants, all animals, and to take in the opportunity to create understanding, I think, across different cultural groups within the Aboriginal population.
I'm just going to do a little pivot here, and it's a little bit sad, I suppose, to talk about if we go down to the Gold Coast and we talk about, you know, I recall that there's a Bora ring that's sort of just sitting in the middle of the Gold Coast Highway. All of those sacred sites are sort of going, you know, we're losing all of those, which I'll get you to comment on. But also, if you don't mind, you shared with us once a story about how you were helping recover some bodies down the Gold Coast.
It's interesting. We drive down the Gold Coast and we see the plastic paradise that sort of exists in the current world. It's interesting to realise that within a couple of hundred metres of surface paradise at Cascade Gardens were remains of people that were taken from along the edges of that Cascade Garden site from along the river. And that continued all the way down in the dunes, down to Burley Heads and probably beyond that point into what is currently New South Wales. But what happened was that there was an understanding, a terrible understanding in some ways, where the stories about Aboriginal people and bodies that were being found on the Gold Coast were not being recognised. And so there was a story that came into ours where a member of the police force was drinking at a hotel on the northern end of Southport, the hotel which still exists. And a person came to the bar in the 1960s and put a skull on the bar and wanted to see if anybody would buy it. For that opportunity, a sergeant of police was drinking there at that night and then asked where these came from, to find out there were many, many hundreds of bones and pieces that were being found down at Burley. So what had happened was that Queensland Government never had an archaeologist. Queensland Government at that time had very poor or no real legislation that guarded the remains of any individuals. But individuals from various groups on the Gold Coast, plus university students, were given the opportunity to go and collect these bones over a short period of time. An archaeologist had come from overseas, from Iceland, and she was pregnant at the time. And she gave birth whilst the dig was on, and because we had so few weeks, she actually took her child and put her child in a sling bag and hung her child after it had been fed and continued on with the dig to be part of that time in the Gold Coast. So in those few weeks, they recovered a large number of bones on the burial sites of what we would refer to as the dunes behind the Gold Coast, near the Gold Coast Highway. Those remains are currently being interred at the back of Merrimack State High School, and in a spot in a particular box to keep them safe, unfortunately. But they've been returned to their sites. And it's interesting to see that we retain part of a borer ring right before you get into the township of Burley Heads. On the left-hand side of the road, you'll find one ring. That was a three-ring process which went across the current Gold Coast Highway. The men's ring is the ring that exists, and it's where the Aboriginal people will gather for the last 20-odd years. And on the 11th of the 11th, we have a recommendation that everybody would come and celebrate the opportunity to see what black diggers have done over time, opportunities to talk about black resistance as well, but to celebrate that as a positive day on Armistice Day with the 11th of the 11th at the 11th hour, and that has been going for a long time. You can visit the site at any time and you'll find it's been locked off for the circle, the original circle with copper's logs, but it's a way that we've come to try to compromise the opportunity to have the values of the Yugambeh people from the past and to recognise the fact that those changes, as bad as they have been, the remains have at least been taken off some of the sites. When you think of what was the alternative was Bruce Small's Gold Coast. Bruce Small, for probably 9 years, collected those bones along with the topsoil that was on the dunes, and they were crushed in an old cement mixer, and then were spread and sold around the Gold Coast at topsoil. So in some ways, the story is a positive one if you think about the fact that Aboriginal people are now spread beyond their grounds, and many people would have Aboriginal remains remains as particles due to the soil and activities within their own backyards of the Gold Coast.
Wow.
We wonder, I think, over time how you know, legislation has made that change. It was only Sunday of this week that we had that huge blowing up of caves by Rio Tinto in Western Australia. And it shows the difference between cultural understanding and the legal elements of, you know, native title or whatever you want to call it at any time. But we're talking about something that's culturally beyond that. You know, why does the Gold Coast now not feel culturally active for Aboriginal people when we've tried to do so? We've actually introduced many things to the Gold Coast, but it doesn't feel like going to the Bunyas. It doesn't have that connection with nature. It doesn't have that connection with the real world, which is really sad and really an opportunity for us to think about how we need to change our habits and our understanding about how we associate with nature.
Speaking about connecting to nature, when you were a headmaster, I'm not sure what school was near Beenleigh, wasn't it? And then you introduced like bees for your like little kids. Were you the first person to sort of bring that in?
Not the first. I mean, I think that's where historically we've probably had some changes over the years. We've had an old habit in Queensland of having Wattle Day from the early 1900s. We've had various forms of understanding about animals and plants in schools. And those clubs that were called, you know, garden clubs or plant clubs or whatever have sort of faded out. So the reintroduction of bees into a school was an essential part. So I've introduced bees into a number of schools and been able to make sure, regardless of the challenges of OH&S, we have the opportunity to be able to associate the real world with real people and be able to find something which is also productive, fun and useful at the same time.
Have you done any research or anything formal around bush medicine?
In the past, I had an opportunity to have a Churchill Fellowship when there were a few of us around and looked at suicide around the world in a lot of Indigenous populations. So I managed to look at that in Hawaii and across into the US and into Canada and into looking at Roma gypsy groups in Belgium and into Norway to look at lapse and connection. What you'll find across all of those groups is an association with story, with plants, with animals, with association with the real world and real change. And I think from my research, I mean, I looked at the harsh elements of suicide, why teenage girls were actually more resilient. And I looked at a ways in which we could translate that back into the Australian context. But my constant research has been about how you maintain resilience, how a person under a COVID type restriction could maintain resilience. How you as an individual, despite what happens in our real world, we're surrounded by elements. We may have that opportunity to strike out and do something different. But do we pick up that challenge? How do we cope with death? How do we cope with being poor? How do we cope with being poor health when you have never been unhealthy in your life before? How do you take those opportunities and translate those into actions for yourself? And what you'll find is that in many cases, it's the hidden senses which we had across past cultures which really come back to the fore if you let them flow. So that opportunity to smell and to taste and to think and to reflect and to sit quietly and to be able to absorb and feel that you're part of something is really the key. And I think, for example, with smell and taste and the opportunity to see, if you get a lot of people, for example, that look out on the vegetation, look at rainforests, they'll see green. And then after a while, you'll say, how many shades of green? No, it's all green. Well, let's have a look at how many shades of green. Now, what other colours can you see? So you'll very quickly pick up 12 to 14 different shades of green. And let's have a look at reds or oranges and browns. And look at this. So, you know, we're looking at the diversity which exists in nature. And I think that's where it goes. So with each of those colours goes smells. With each of those smells, you know, how does that particular work? Let's have a look at how all our senses come alive. And that really what makes us part of the animal connection with our world.
So favourite medicine plant?
For me, it's a Gumby Gumby. So Gumby Gumby is a small shrub. It's actually two versions. One is a tree version, which inhabits central Queensland. And Gumby Gumby is seen by many Aboriginal people and now by the wider population as a much more suitable opportunity to pick up something which has various use. So very high in antioxidants. So it's been used to be able to create medicines, as in a dry powder. It's being able to be crushed to be able to use for tea. It's been able to be added to sorbeline to be able to use. There are lots of creams to stop itches and rashes, but it's also been used as an opportunity to deeply rub in for massage and to be able to take away that sting and that pain that goes on. So Gumby Gumby is a tree. I like it as a tea, and lots of people drink it as teas, but it's really one of those very, very versatile plants. And if we think back to the early days of people coming onto the bunyas, a shiny person was considered to be a good-looking person, somebody that you'd want to marry and develop this kinship relationship with. So a shiny-skinned woman or a shiny-skinned male, and if you're black and shiny, that means that you're really very, very, very special. So bunyas are very high in a particular opportunity with oils. So the bunya oil was added, and then they used to add other oils, and the other oil that they'd add, if they're trying to do that, was Gumby Gumby, and then they'd add another oil from maybe taken from an animal, like an echidna, and that was able to be taken. So often they're not taken in isolation; they're joined together for all sorts of reasons. So if we think about them as a cosmetic, if we think about them as a traditional medicine, if we think about them as something that which you can use to create a fire and they burn with the leaf, if you think it's something which you can drink, something which you can eat and nibble on, something which will take away your thirst if you're really out on the dry plain, it really means that you've got the versatile tool to take in any shape or form that you've got it. So it's one of those many plants that create the options for us, and I think that's fantastic. But we've got to be able to learn about it. So we've got to have that opportunity to listen and to see and to try and taste. Yeah. So you can come to the Bunya Mountains and you can try Bunya ice cream. You can try Bunya biscuits. You can try Bunya flour, scones, etc. You can go to many outdoor markets and you can find Gumby Gumby being used and sold as powder, as tea, and also in hand cream. So, you know, there's lots of mixes and lots of opportunities. So opportunities exist out there for all of us.
There was some university studies being done on Gumby Gumby and looking at it for pain relief. Now, thinking about the poor old bunyas, do you know roughly how many trees are sort of in that area?
They're in the hundreds, unfortunately, and we've lost some, you know, some major trees. What you'll probably see, which is the experience from the Karri Forest of WA and the experience in New Zealand, the pines are affected. So the concept of a bunya tree is an Araucaria bidwilli, the guy who gave the name to it. And so Bidwilli was the man who collected this tree originally. So the tree in Kew Gardens came from the bunyas. The tree in Sydney on the near Lady Macquarie's chair. The trees match also the ones at Murray Bridge and were carried and planted by individuals. So what we're seeing is the opportunity that those trees haven't become affected. What we're now seeing is the fact that probably through stock food and through wild pigs and the saliva of pigs that's been dropped to the tree has caused this Phytophthora to be able to do it.
How long does it take before it sort of impacts the tree? Is it like 10 years? It's slow acting?
It seems to be probably taking at the moment about 5 years before we're showing definite signs. And then the death rate, because it's in the root base of the tree, is relatively quick. So the DPI, the Department of Primary Industries, as it was, has been doing some research, and we've actually submitted trees to the Biological Control Centre in Brisbane to be able to be grown up and to be diseased with the different sorts of Phytophthora and to be able to look at the beginnings of solutions. But it's not just our national parks. Expect in the future we probably look like many New Zealand parks, where we have to wash our boots and scrub our shoes before entering a national park, whether you're going for 5 minutes or 5 days.
I'm sure there are a lot of stories that have been told around the bunya trees. And that's why I think it's so sad that they're dying, because of when they die, are we losing that part of the story? So I think it's important for us to sort of keep the stories alive. So is there any stories that you can share with us and with our audience around bunya?
Stories have a definite significant importance in an oral culture. So you're dealing with Aboriginal people across a wide landscape that came to the bunyas from, you know, huge walking distances, and life and death occurred upon the way of those walks. And it's amazing to think that the original stories relate to the fact that in the sky was the power of navigation. In the sky was the power of where you would find your relatives and your past. It's in the sky that you'd find your directions to live your life. So that idea of contemplation and reflection could be from there. So the story of the bunyas is related to very large clouds that were in the sky. And in those particular clouds, or on those particular clouds, existed a series of bunya forests. And there were people on the bunya forests who had particularly large forests, very, very big clouds, very, very big forests. And on those particular clouds, one person ate all of their bunyas on their particular cloud. And so they went to the person on the nearby cloud to be able to say, can we have some of your bunyas? And they eventually, along with the group that lived on that other cloud, ate their bunyas as well. So eventually they decided to go to another cloud. And this continued on until it came down to one cloud and one bunya tree left. And that bunya tree was in fruit. And so that gigantic bunya tree that existed on that cloud in that time, the guy who owned that, who really didn't own it, but wanted to say, do I share or do I take or do I create, had decided, in my opinion, to create. So that bunya tree also started to die, because it couldn't exist on just one bunya tree in order to propagate and to continue on. So the person who was responsible for that bunya tree took not just the last of the seed cones, came down to one seed cone because of the generosity of all these other groups, and took that seed cone and threw that seed cone to earth. And it threw on that distance as it was coming through the sky, that caught fire, and it came burning to the landscape. It scorched the landscape, and it forced that particular seed into the ground. And that seed grew to become the bunya forest that we know today. So the stories behind all of that are obvious, I think, to us across many cultures. But it's also very important to Aboriginal people, because you learnt the stories of how you relate to food, and how you relate to greed, and how you relate to your friends and your relatives. So it's reflected in also in those stories and processes. Today we have this process of acknowledgement to country and welcome to country. And many people, including me, are probably not excited by what you hear and you see by people. So acknowledgement of country should be done at all stages, to acknowledge the country in which you're on, no matter who you are, where you come from, and how you settle into that site. Welcome to country is done by somebody who belongs to that country, to that language group, and to that site. But the acknowledgement needs to be set in time, because in the previous time, people had to wait off country to be invited onto country. And I'm sure many of you realise what it's like if you've got a great house and a great spot to be able to have your relatives come and visit for a long period of time. And if you consider the fact that your food source and your water source is highly restricted by the number of people around you at one time. So the stories of relating your welcome to country are sit off outside, wait until you're invited, wait until the elders in the past have had that discussion, if we can cater for that number of people, if they're not warlike, if we don't want angry relatives, and if we can get them onto our particular place in time, how long are they going to stay, and what are the rules of engagement in terms of how we share food and how we've got anything to be able to do that. And when they leave, you know, what are they doing? So I think all of us can relate to that if you've had visitors in your house for a long period of time, or perhaps a short period of time. And then we move on to the next bit of country. So it's significant that many of those stories are reflected in practices. If we think about the strangeness of how it's now become formalised and perhaps sometimes done in a weird way in terms of welcome to country. That came from the days of Ernie Dingo and another ABC reporter in the 1990s when they invited the Maoris to come to open an arts festival in WA. And when they did that, the whole idea of welcome to country was the Maori said to them very simply at the beginning, we are going to show you up. We are going to do a haka that will put you on your knees. What are you guys going to do? So the challenge that came that led to the first welcome to country being given in that particular manner, like we do it today, which seems to me to lack a lot of the meaning in many, not all cases, but in many cases of real people acknowledging you and welcoming you onto the country, was done in the 1990s through the expertise of Wally, the ABC reporter, and Ernie Dingo as a way to counter a Maori visitation to an arts festival in Perth. So it's, you know, habits come, habits change. Now it's become institutionalised within the structure. My point is the stories have got to be meaningful. The reasons behind it have got to be meaningful. If you can make all of those realistic and attainable in the long term, then certainly you've got the opportunity to make real positive change.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing just a small snippet of your life, because I know that you've done so many amazing things. It's always a pleasure to work with you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Danielle. Likewise.
Thanks for listening to Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Please subscribe to the podcast and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.